quick announcement. Linguistics Career Launch 2024 is happening this summer. It will be a two-week event taking place online from July 15th through July 26th, 2024. This is a boot camp that takes linguists in training and in transition from coursework to career through panels, courses, guest speakers, and networking events. Check out our website at linguisticscareerlaunch.com for more information, and then join us July 15th to the 26th, 2024, to access the career management methods you need to research and apply to jobs that use linguistics in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. Emily Sabo is a writer and data analyst who specializes in scientific communication, applied research, and digital content creation. While she was earning her PhD at the University of Michigan, she traveled around South America, Europe, and Asia, researching how languages are processed in the bilingual brain. In her industry career, she's written and produced YouTube videos and podcasts for a language learning app. She's also had experience in stand-up comedy and gave a TEDx talk on the power of language. Topics discussed include public relations, language teaching, changing identity, job search, content development, content marketing, brand engagement, interviewing, and moral issues. Links to Emily's LinkedIn profile and other resources mentioned in the discussion are in the show notes. I would like to welcome Emily Sabo to our podcast today. Emily has had a really amazing career, has worked for a company that some of our other interviewees have worked for, Mango Languages, but has also done some other stuff. So I would love to hear your story, Emily. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, Laurel. It's a pleasure to be here and talk. So I guess I can start with sharing kind of why I chose linguistics and how I even became such a language nerd in the first place. So I guess the short story is that I studied Spanish in high school and then had the very cool opportunity to get to actually travel to Spain in high school. And I always tell this story because I think it's important. I went to Spain. I was like, oh my gosh, like real people speak this language that I've been learning in class. And I've learned now in hindsight, now that I've been doing this for, you know, over a decade, people ask me like, why language? And they ask me like, oh, well, do you like coding languages? And I'm like, no, I really don't. I do it when I have to. And they ask why, and it's a good question. And the answer is because learning languages has been my way of connecting with people. And so it kind of is a code that cracks open access to more people in the world. And I don't get that same access with coding languages. So I came back from that trip to Spain thinking like, wow, I can now travel and connect with so many more people because of this cool language I've learned. And then the irony, of course, is that, you know, as a, you know, a naive 16-year-old, I took my first job working at a fast food joint. I guess I won't mention the name of which one, I don't know. But I started working there and half of my colleagues were native Spanish speakers. And I was like, oh my gosh, like this language has been alive and well in my suburban community. Like I didn't have to go to Europe to discover that I could speak this, you know, truly with people. It's in my backyard. So I think that's been a fun find of my life is that language doesn't just allow you to travel, which is, I think, what kind of first got me interested. It's also getting to connect with people at home that you otherwise wouldn't get to connect with.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's true for a lot of linguists. It's the communication part of it is so important. And whether you come at it from a second language perspective or just a, you know, a syntax and semantics perspective, what you're trying to get to is like, how does this communication happen? Isn't it amazing that we're using sound waves to actually transfer our thoughts to each other? It's pretty amazing stuff.
It is. I couldn't agree more.
So how did you find out about linguistics then as a now a multilingual person?
Yeah. So I actually went into my undergrad with the plan of public relations and Spanish as a double major. And then I started getting into public relations and it was a lot of advertising in my first semester. And I was like, you know, I don't think this is it for me. And so I switched to K-12 Spanish Ed. So I was set up to be a K-12 Spanish teacher. And I did my, I want to call it internship, student teaching. I've been in industry now too long. But I did my student teaching and I got the sense that, when I talked with my teachers, my Spanish teachers from high school as well, and there was just this overwhelming sense, Laurel, of burnout among teachers. And this is pre-COVID, right? And I wasn't honestly ready to take that on. I kind of felt like there was more that I needed to do. And I think in the back of my mind, I thought, okay, well, I will do something. Maybe it's travel for a year, figure it out, maybe do grad school, and then maybe I'll come back and teach, and then maybe I'll be ready. But life, always takes its own path, as I'm sure you know. And so I ended up applying for a Fulbright in Korea. And then I lived in Korea for a little bit over a year. I also did the CLS scholarship, which, if folks don't know about that, I'd highly recommend checking it out, the Critical Language Scholarship. That's how I learned Korean in the first place. And then I got the Fulbright after that and taught English in Korea, in South Korea, of course.
Sorry, I have to ask, what was your level of Korean when you went over there?
What a great question. It was nothing. So the first time I went was with the Critical Language Scholarship, and that program was mostly for folks who, there was a range, but most of the folks did not speak Korean. Some did. That's it, that scholarship depends. If you're going for something like, I believe like Chinese is a bit more competitive, and it might require you to have some more Mandarin under your belt. But so for Korean, I knew at the time Gangnam Style and Psy were super popular, and I knew Psy, and I knew how to say like, "Hi, my name is," and I taught myself the alphabet, which is actually very simple for anyone who wants a fun, simple alphabet. But that program was intense, to be honest. It was, if you were caught speaking English more than 3 times, they sent you back to the States. It was a State Department program, so you were not even supposed to send emails to your family in English. You were supposed to translate them, and they'd have to back translate them. So it was, and I didn't get the, so I think the point there is I didn't get to have the personal connections as much on that trip, because I lived in a dorm and with my textbook for 3 months. But then when I did the Fulbright, I got to actually live in Korea and like experience Korea. So yeah, I did that, and then during that time, I decided, what I wanted to do was apply for linguistics for a PhD. And I knew that that was the next path for me, because in undergrad, my thesis, I would love to shout out John Lipsky and Julie Ducius, were my two mentors at Penn State, and they helped me figure out what research is and like how to do it. And so I had my taste of doing linguistic research and writing up a, I mean, a mini dissertation, I guess. We called it a thesis. And that was all based on research that I had, sociolinguistic interviews and phonetic experiments that I had run actually during my study abroad while in Ecuador. And so I knew I loved to travel, and I loved to interview people and make little experiments and write about them. And so I translated that into applying for a PhD program. And my husband, my then boyfriend, is from Ecuador, and so we were trying to figure out a way to live together. And he applied to grad school programs for mechanical engineering, and the one school that we overlapped in was University of Michigan, which, actually, this is relevant to the time that we're recording this podcast, because we found out on April 1st that we had both been accepted. I had already been accepted, and then he shared on April 1st that he had also been accepted, and I was like, "You wouldn't joke about this, right?" But then we went to grad school, and that's and then 5 years later, I graduated. 5 and a half years later.
That's so interesting, and such a, I will say, a stroke of luck that that happened.
Agreed.
One of the themes that runs through a lot of the conversations I've had with people, both when it comes to talking about grad school, but then your life after grad school, is that as you said, real life happens and you can't predict it, but it's not a thing that really gets talked about a lot. You know, like it's not when you go to apply for grad school, you can't say to them, really, I'm going here because my husband or my boyfriend or my partner is applying here. And it would be great if both of us got in at the same time. But it's sort of the same thing after you finish as well. You know, if you're applying for jobs, whether they're academic jobs or industry jobs, it's not just you. Like you have to think about your family and your partner and your friends and where you want to live. And, you know, I think in industry, it's a little more above board. Like people do talk and think about that. But in academia, it's always like you're in this little bubble all by yourself. And, you know, sure, you can go take a job in some faraway state where you don't know anybody. And, you know, it's like, no, that's not actually the way that, that life works.
That's why I think these conversations are genuinely so helpful, because you won't get this information from someone's LinkedIn profile, right?
Right.
Not because even, not even really because we're hiding it, right? But it's not the relevant platform on your bio to say, you know, here's the behind the scenes, you know, rationale for why I chose this school and why I ended up in Tennessee. And, you know, all of these things kind of come out when you're talking in spaces like this. So I think they're really important.
Yeah, totally. And for the people who are listening, it makes you feel like you're not alone. Like I do totally understand how when you're in graduate school or you're applying or you're just out, you feel like you're the only person in the world who's facing this problem. It's like, oh, everybody else has it sorted out. And here I am struggling because I don't want to move far away from my family. It's like, well, that's valid. That's totally valid.
Yeah. You know, and it's, this is, I was actually just talking about this with a couple of other, PhD friends, some in, you know, linguistic area, anthropology, and then some in STEM. And I now, having been in, I'll continue to share kind of the trajectory of how I got to where I am, but having been in academia and then now in industry, I can say, I mean, I learned so much in during my PhD in academia. But I can say with full certainty that I've learned faster in industry. And I think that I wish that I'd had the opportunity in grad school to, or if I'd made the opportunity for myself, perhaps to find an industry internship, even for a couple of months, because even if I were going to stay in academia and that's kind of what I wanted to do, you learn, it's kind of like getting out of your academia bubble, right? You learn not only a faster pace way of working and collaborating with others, but you also learn, like, just, you know, life hacks and work hacks even the systems and the tools that you use in academia might be different from industry. So just having the experience in both, I think I probably would have finished my dissertation faster. I probably would have, approached grad school a little bit differently if I just had that dip into industry earlier.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I have heard anecdotally that there are more and more universities that are incorporating internships into their PhD programs.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. That was what I was bringing up to my friends. You know, I was like, I just wish that would have been a thing. And I hope that that's a thing moving forward. So that's great to hear.
Yeah, I think it's sort of born out of necessity, unfortunately, not that they see the value in it so much, but they, you know, they need people to get some experience and prove their worth and, you know, earn some money if it's a paid internship, if they're not being supported by the department. And it just makes so much sense. And it, a lot of it too comes back to the problem of no jobs, because departments, I think, are finally starting to wake up to the fact that they're preparing all these people with PhDs for jobs that don't exist in academia. Like, they're simply not there.
Right. Yeah. It's a very weird, and I know that the listeners on this podcast will resonate with this, and you know that you know this is the state of things. But the number of spots in a PhD program, and what the students that you know we're churning out, there just aren't enough spots in tenure track positions. And even if some people don't even want them, right?
Exactly.
I think a lot of people that go from academia to industry have this kind of, I don't know, like a chip on your shoulder when you talk to academics. It's like, oh, I guess you couldn't hack it, or I guess you didn't
Totally.
make it. And it's this kind of unspoken, like, I don't know, this it's a trope that I think is just so outdated. And I just wish that the current grad students who are listening to this, or people who are in the job market, truly don't feel that way, because it's not that academia is better or that industry is better. It's just that they're, I mean, realistically, there are just more industry jobs.
Yeah, totally.
And it kind of opens in a lot, and in some ways that's a good thing, because there's so many cool jobs that are beyond academia. And to be honest about like what it is that we do in a PhD program, it's like you amass all this knowledge and then educate the next generation, which is extremely valuable. But only so many people need to do that, right? Then the other people need to take all the knowledge they gain and apply it to some field. And so I think there just needs to be like a, I think this is changing, but like just a general respect for those who stay in academia and those who, shift to industry, whether they did it because they wanted to or because they felt they had to.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I agree with you that I think it's changing. It's changing slowly, but I certainly had the experience of that the pity party thing, like, oh, you left, you didn't finish your PhD, that's too bad. Oh, you founded a really successful company, but you never finish. Well, too bad. Come on. Let's be real about this. So that kind of leads to the next part of this. Like, as you're finishing your PhD, you said you were thinking about going into academia. What changed? What made you decide, like, nope, this isn't going to work?
Okay, yeah, that's a great question. So I for me, it was that I personally don't enjoy fundamental theoretical research. So, and that's a problem if you want to be
Sure.
a productive scholar. And I also think I'm the kind of person that likes to every couple years kind of like shift my focus and do something new. And the way that academia, I mean, at least in linguistics right now, is set up in terms of incentives and career growth, is the best way to excel in a tenure track position is to focus on a really specific topic and become the expert on that, so that you can publish very quickly. You have to do a lot of learning, in between each project, because you're switching focus. You're just, continuing. And I think it takes a certain like personality and work brain for that. And for me, I just get, I can't focus on, South Afrikaans Rhodics for 30 years. Like, I don't have the, I don't know, the attention span, I guess you could say. But I get burnt out on the topic. And so I realized that doing fundamental theoretical research wasn't how I wanted to spend my time, but I still loved the university atmosphere. I loved, I still love, teaching. I love mentoring. There's just like a special energy on a university campus. There's all this like potential, and everyone's trying to figure out what they want to do with their lives, and it's just such a special time in a young person's, I mean, there's unconventional students of course too, but it's just a very special group to work with. And so I think for that reason, I actually, after finishing my PhD, well, there was overlap, so I was a COVID PhD defender, dissertation defender. And so for the last semester in which I was finishing up my dissertation, I also took a virtual teaching position at the University of Tennessee. So I was teaching Spanish. And then I ended up getting my job at Mango the next semester. And I actually kept my part-time position at the University of Tennessee just because I love teaching, and I didn't want to give it up. And there was part of, I mean, like if I'm speaking honestly, there was also a part of not wanting to let go of my academic identity. And so I kind of clung to it. And then, but then I, not to speak too poorly of University of Tennessee, because it's an amazing university, but the, like any other R1, research institution, they don't value teachers. They don't value, and I was an adjunct there. It was a part-time position. And I truly, Laurel, could not get behind the, how undervalued the teachers and the lecturers and the adjunct professors there were treated. It just was honestly very depressing. Like working with the students was great, but it was such a different vibe shift from being a PhD student, at University of Michigan to a lecturer, a part-time lecturer at University of Tennessee. And like my colleagues there, I had started, I'm pretty open with sharing. I think it's helpful when people are feel comfortable to share, what they make, here and there. But I think I was making about $5,000 per class, and I was teaching two classes per semester for that part-time position. And I was making the same salary that my colleagues in the same position who had been there for 30 years were making. They hadn't been adjusted for any inflation, nothing for 15, 20 years. And so there was a salary compression issue. And I was actually on a call with the, I don't want to misname them. I believe it was a vice provost, but it was someone with, more power than a lecturer. And on the call, I said, well, the reason that, the lecturers had a labor union. And so they were basically saying, hey, there's the salary compression issue. Like, what are you going to do about it? And I mean, she said nothing. She said, we're probably nothing was her answer. And I said, well, I think the reason that everyone's so upset is because, like many other institutions, UT is not unique in this way. There's a value for tenure track research professors and not for the teaching lecture staff. And there needs to be some, they're treated, they're on contract. We were on contracts, right? So it's like every semester, every year, you actually didn't know if you were going to have the job again. And they made that very clear, right? They said, we don't plan a year ahead because you don't know if you're going to be here. So it wasn't a community. And when I spoke up, that I guess vice provost said something like, yeah, well, I do think if you're starting out and you just got a PhD, honestly, you should probably go into industry because, or I don't see this changing, unfortunately. So there was empathy. I genuinely appreciated the professional candor, right? I don't think it was necessarily appropriate for that call for everyone who'd been there for 40 years to hear that. But I mean, for me individually, it was helpful because it reinforced my decision, which I had already made, that that was going to be my last semester. Mostly because it was just too much to try to do a full-time industry job with that. But that was definitely part of it.
What you're this is such an interesting story, and thank you for being so open about it. And I think your experience is not unique. You know, this is happening at universities all over and will continue to happen, especially because university graduate students have been unionizing, and that changes everything because for decades, universities have relied on essentially the slave labor of grad students to do all the teaching, and now they're not going to be able to do that anymore. So that's a paradigm shift. But beyond that, I think what you're saying is something that people who are in graduate programs kind of have to learn to do for themselves as they move into industry, if that's where they want to go. And that's just basically to stop thinking of yourself as slave labor and, you know, to be grateful for people. And that's why things like salary negotiations can be so difficult for ex-academics, because in academia, you know, typically you're not negotiating and you're not in a position where sometimes multiple companies might be making an offer for you if you know you happen to be in that place. And it can be really difficult to just think of yourself, as you said, for one thing, shedding your persona as an academic and moving into your persona, your new persona as a linguist in industry, and really valuing yourself and your work and asking for things and not being treated like, sorry, we can't do anything about this because you know what? If it's not so good, leave, get a different job. And that's just not something that we're taught to do, to expect to have as a possibility, because the whole structure of academia versus industry is so different. And it's just not something that you think about as you're leaving and you're starting to look for jobs. Like, you know, we should all be so proud of our intelligence and our knowledge, which is so special and so different and so valuable, and to take that into things like salary negotiations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think too, the when you mentioned kind of letting go of like a tight grip of the academic identity, I think that's another important note for folks who are, you know, current grad students who are looking for industry jobs, or anyone who's looking to shift into industry in general, it's, you have to also be open to switching how you talk about yourself online.
Yes, absolutely.
Because I struggle with this because I didn't, so in my job at Mango, right, it's a language learning app, they know what a linguist is. So you can, you know, calling yourself a linguist is something they understand. And sure, I did other things there and we can talk about that. But in my current job, which is at a market research company, you know, internally, we have other linguists, PhDs, one of them is my friend from grad school. They know what a linguist is, but it's not a valued term necessarily, mm-hmm. because the goal of what we're doing isn't building a language learning app. It's in our case, we're conducting research, applied research for healthcare and pharmaceutical companies. So, and patients. And so I think it's talking, giving yourself different keywords and tags is a strategic shift. And it's also an identity shift that you have to be open to, because mm-hmm. it does. I mean, I hung on some, I actually think I still have my UT and my University of Michigan cards, like ID cards, just because I couldn't give
yeah,
them up.
Sure.
And so I think that's just a great metaphor for, you know, someone who's now been in industry since, you know, 2020 or 2021, I guess, you know, 3+ years. I'm still like, you know, I'm still remembering that I come from academia and that it's part of my experience, but it's not really, it's not an active identity anymore.
Right.
I've kind of grown into a new role.
Yeah, that I agree with everything you just said. So to get back to the nitty gritty, how did you get that job at Mango Languages?
Okay, yeah. So my approach, and I've done a lot of, I really enjoy doing this. I've done a lot of informational interviews or calls with folks who are looking to go into industry, who have come from linguistics. And that is the first question, right? It's always, how did you get the job?
Mm-hmm.
I want that job. And my advice is to not wait for a job to be posted. Sure, if there are cool jobs that are posted, absolutely apply. But don't let that limit you on what you think is available. So for example, my approach was, I want to look for companies and people that I want to work with, and then I'm going to reach out to them and tell them what I'm interested in doing and see if they might have a need for those
mm-hmm.
things. So
mm-hmm.
the first, this was just a freelance job, but the first job that I got was, I think it was also while I was finishing up my PhD. That was a busy time. I reached out to the owners of Lingopie. Have you heard of them?
No, I have not.
Okay. So yeah, for you and for our listeners, it's a really cool language learning app or, you know, platform.
Mm-hmm.
Their whole model is, if you're going to binge TV on Netflix and streaming, you might as well do it in your target language. So it's kind of binge your way to language proficiency. So they have all of these licensed TV shows that are kind of, you know, fun. And I would say not dry is kind of how I would describe the genre. And, very, very fun. And then you can, you know, change the speed at which you listen and have subtitles in either language. And it's very cool. And so I reached out to them, actually reached out to the CEO, David Dattney, who I'm friends with now. And I said, hey, I am graduating from my PhD program in linguistics. I really love kind of the tone and the vibe that your company and product strikes. I would love to create content for you guys. Is that something, whether within your program or as content marketing for your company, is that something that you have a need for or are interested
mm-hmm.
in? And at the time, they were, you know, like a newer startup based out of Israel and New York. And this was COVID time, so everything was virtual already. And I ended up hopping on a call with him and then the COO. And they said, yeah, actually, we've been looking for someone to help us with content marketing. Let's set up a, you know, a freelance contract and just take it, you know, month by month or project
mm-hmm.
by project. And so I worked with a couple of folks on their marketing team, and we produced a fun YouTube video you could find on YouTube. I think they called it the Sabo Show, which is my last name. Which
okay, that's hilarious.
My ego was like, oh my gosh, wow, thanks.
Uh-huh.
But that was really fun. And but that partnership, I guess, got cut short because I did find the mango position, and that was a full time, with benefits and more stability. And so I'll share how I found the mango position, but I ended up telling them for non-compete reasons I couldn't continue working with them.
Sure.
But the mango position I found similarly, I had reached out to, I don't know if I recommend this for everyone. It depends on your personality. Because some people might interpret this way, but I think I reached out to probably like 5 people in the company. Which some people listening might think, ooh, that sounds like, she's stalking them, which maybe. but it was, done tactfully and tastefully. And so I reached out to a couple of the linguists, and then maybe also the CEO of Mango. And I think 1 or 2 people got back to me, and they were on the sales team. And they said, hey, we don't have anything available now, but I looked at your LinkedIn, and I feel like we could really use you, honestly. And so I said, oh, that's so nice. Great. Keep me in mind. Let me know if anything comes up. And then I guess like 2 months later, the perfect position was created. I don't actually know if this was created based on those conversations. I should have asked. But I think they noticed that they needed their social media was, their words, not mine, stagnant. They didn't have anyone working on it. And so they wanted their, Instagram, their YouTube, their podcast. They didn't have any podcast yet, but their blogs, they wanted them to be more fun and relatable and to help them gain traction, right? Because of course, you're competing with a free app like Duolingo that everyone in the world knows. So, so then that position came on, and it was for a content marketing linguist. So it was kind of straddling the marketing department and the linguistics team, who does all the behind the scenes coursework within the app. And it was really fun. It was 2 years of, making YouTube videos, Instagram reels, graphics, podcasts, blogs. I got to do conversational interviews. I went to some in-person shows, they call them shows, but conferences, trade shows. And I really, really enjoyed it. I got to be creative, and I got to use linguistics in this really fun applied way.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. Like, how much linguistics were you able to get into all that?
Yeah. And you can see these on, I think YouTube would probably be the best place if you're just trying to get an idea of what kind of videos does someone who does content marketing linguistics, make.
Sure.
If you go onto Mango's YouTube.
I'll put a link in so people can find them easily.
Yeah, absolutely. And they were things like 5 things you didn't know about Arabic, or, what the heck is phonetics? Stuff like that. What is the fluency illusion? That kind of thing. So I really enjoyed it. And then in, what was it? Maybe January of 2021? No, 23. I'm bad with dates. But after being there for like maybe 2.5 years, pretty much my whole team, well, a fourth of the company was let go because they ran into financial issues as a company. And so that was devastating because I felt like a real sense of community at the company. Mm-hmm. And I had built not just co-working friendships, but like actual friendships. And I genuinely felt super valued at the company. It was a really great experience. So I didn't see it coming. And I don't think a lot of other folks that were let go saw it coming either. I mean, I think we all knew they were having financial issues, but you never know what's coming. And so
sure.
I was pretty upset. And when I lost that job, I thought, like, what do I really want to do? This is kind of an opportunity to reimagine. Like, part of me was a little bit burnt out on language. And I mean, I'm always going to love it. Like, even sitting here talking about it, it's like, this is, a work day for me. And I'm doing a lot of non-linguistics-y things. So it's really fun to get to talk about language again.
Yeah.
Part of me just kind of wanted like a new challenge. And so for a couple months, I actually was planning to open up my own dance studio.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's something I've always wanted to do. but it's kind of, it always sat as like a side hobby. And then I thought, well, you know, like it brings me a lot of joy. I already have been teaching, you know, dance, fitness, and yoga classes locally for fun on the side. And I was like, why don't I just do it for myself? And a couple of months in, I just realized like this is not for me. I want this part of my life to be my hobby. I don't want it to be my job. And I also just missed working on a team. Like solopreneurship is, it takes a certain personality, and I don't think I have that personality. I thought, oh, I'm so self-motivated, and it would be great. And I am, but when I'm with a team, you know, there has to be like some kind of shared mission. And so then I started looking for work again, and I was applying. And then the job that I ended up getting was one I didn't apply for. So it's, I think the through line of my career is to plant seeds and see what grows and be surprised by the
Of
things
course.
that do. But this particular position, I currently work for a company called OptiBrand RX. So it's a market research company. I mentioned earlier, we serve mostly, it's client, it's an agency. So we take clients that are, you know, big pharmaceutical companies that you've heard of, like BMS, Novartis, Johnson and Johnson, Bayer, but then also smaller biotech startups, that, you know, have medical devices or therapeutics or, you know, tests. And so my job, it's something, Laurel, I never thought I would do something in that's even related to pharmaceuticals. I think this is like a really important point for people listening, because when I was actively looking for work, I would never have searched the words market researcher, pharmaceutical, like nothing, right? Nothing about this would have caught my eye. The only reason it came on my radar was because a friend of mine, a colleague of mine, who also graduated with me from the linguistics program at University of Michigan, she had started working there, and they had, at the time, OptiBrand was looking for someone who ideally is a linguist and is bilingual in Spanish and English, and could moderate interviews, qualitative interviews with doctors in Spain about their use of pharmaceuticals for metastatic triple negative breast cancer. So I knew nothing about medicine. And I thought, oh, I don't know if I don't have the medical background, you know, for this. And, you know, I really like, so I, but I still reached out because I thought this sounds really interesting. And to be honest, health literacy is something that's kind of been in the back of my mind as something I want personally to get better at. You know, I'm getting older, my parents are getting older, you know, people have deal with disease, and I feel like that's been a gap in my knowledge. And so I was like, you know what, this seems like something that would challenge me, and it's a new application of my skills. Like, let's do a call. So I got on a call with who my now boss, and you know, she described the position. I mean, these companies, they pay really well. To give an estimate figure based on my memory, I didn't end up taking this particular position, but I think the offer was something like, I don't know, like maybe like $10,000 to do 20-hour-long interviews, a couple of client calls, and then maybe like help clean up the transcripts, something like that. So a lot more than I think teaching full course loads at University of Tennessee. And actually, on that call, it turns out someone had just left the company, a data analyst, and so my now boss said, actually, would you be interested in a full-time position? And in the interim, and in talking with her, I had looked on the OptiBrand website, and I thought, oh, like this, they actually have a lot of interesting open positions that are full-time. And one of them was for brand engagement. And so I, you know, I was like, yeah, I'm gonna apply. This looks interesting. And I applied and got a response like the next day from someone else in the company on more of the marketing side, who said, yeah, like let's hop on a call, would love to talk to you. So long story short, on the table was this contract position for Spanish interviews. And on the other hand, this call with the marketing side was, hey, we don't actually have an open position for the job I want you for. I read your resume for what you applied for. I want you for something else. I don't know if this position, I'll get it, a budget for it, but if I do, would you be interested? And so these were two interesting, it's a small company too, right? So I'm like, shouldn't we all talk together about this? But I ended up talking to my current boss and she said, okay, well, actually, this is such a small company that I need you on my team like 100% for now. But at some point, and this has already started happening, I've been there for a little over 3 months. I work fully for my boss on the market research side. But as I'm able, as time permits, I can kind of have fun and like do some creative content marketing work with creating videos and blogs and stuff with the marketing side. So long story short, it was kind of like a Frankenstein position that came together because a friend told me about a contract position that turned into a full-time. And I think this just goes to show like sometimes when you're looking, it's the things you're not looking for that'll come. And it also just takes a little bit of like kind of taking a jump, right, into something you didn't necessarily think you would have been interested in. Now I love it.
Well, I'm struck by a couple of things. One is that just what you were saying about, you know, keep your options open, plant those seeds. It's something we need to do. But also, I'm really struck by the number of times that you reached out to people, they connected with you and they read your resume and they said, I think we could use you for X, right? So they were basing it off of not you presenting as like, I have a PhD or, you know, it was like they looked at your resume and they saw your skill set and you apparently did a really good job of describing what your strengths are. And they realized what a valuable person you could be. And I think that's something we, you know, as linguists, we know that the field is changing in industry, like people are recognizing it, but it's not because you're a linguist, I'm putting that in quotes, it's because of your skill set. And that's super important to be able to, as you said, to talk about your skill set to people who aren't linguists in a way that they're going to be able to understand. You know, what you were talking about doing this interpretation in interviews, I mean, that's just field research, right?
Exactly.
We all know how to do that. That's the way you do it. And it's like for linguists, I think that kind of work is second nature. But for people who own companies like the company you work at, it's a real valuable skill that not many people have, that they just don't understand it. You know, my career has been in marketing myself, and I've worked with a lot of market research firms and sat in, you know, dozens and dozens of focus groups, and I've seen online surveys and stuff like that. And, you know, if you don't have any kind of linguistic training, it's going to be bad. I've seen so many bad interviews, so many bad focus groups, because the people who were doing it just aren't sensitive to language. And that's what you need to know. Like, that's where linguists need to work, is in that space between what companies are doing, what their customers or potential customers want, and being the conduit for that. It's so valuable. And so it's just one aspect of having a linguistic training that I think is super important, and is the field is just ripe for linguists to step into those kinds of positions with all these skills. And especially if you're multilingual, you know, you're even more sought after. So I just wanted to highlight that. And then the other thing, I wanted to just come back to what you were saying about knowing yourself and what you're good at and what you feel comfortable doing. Like, you know, you were talking about the dance studio and you realizing like, I can't do this. And this is also something that everybody has to learn about themselves as they're looking for a job. Like, you know, you have to find the right match of the type of job that works with your personality type, right? Not everybody is going to be good at the same things. And I don't mean good at in terms of skill set, but working in a team. Some people like you love working in a team. That's where you thrive. Other people, not so much. And you're never going to thrive if you're in the wrong work environment. And I feel you, because I'm kind of like that too. I like working on a team. I like working by myself too, but also I have a short attention span. So, you know, project work for me is perfect, because I can dive in to a project and be an expert and know every single thing about it for 3 months, and then it's done. And then I can go on to the next thing.
You bring up such a good point. And I think I've heard this from a lot of folks, right? I mean, academia is it's a long, the papers that we write, that we publish are very long, slow conversations, right? You write, you know, I have one paper that it took us, this is like embarrassing, but it took us, you know, my team, the 6 years to publish it from the inception of the idea to running the experiments, fixing issues, actually writing it, people graduating, picking the project back up. Like that would never happen in industry because there is this external, especially with client work. And that's what's nice about it is there's a sense of urgency. There is a deadline. It's very real. And there's money on the line. And so I actually think that in some cases, my work is better when there's a tight deadline.
Yep.
When I have less time, because I'm motivated. There's, you know, this fire. Not that I think I don't want to be stressed all the time. It's less about stress and more about, just getting to focus on a project and then move on to the next one. And I think that is a really beautiful thing about industry. And if you're the kind of person that, you know, getting burnt out on your topic or, you know, bored with it, then industry can be a really great option. And look, I don't think that I really agree with your point about linguists, especially sociolinguists, kind of having this natural knack for conducting, you know, market research interviews or any kind of interviews for industry. I don't think that it's a requisite that you need to be a linguist, you know, to be good at those, but I really think that it helps. And I think it's one of those jobs that I honestly don't think I ever, during grad school, when we had like our, you know, industry panels or something, you know, job seeking panels, I don't think I ever heard anybody talk about that.
Yes. I was just going to say, you didn't know about it because nobody ever told you that it exists as an actual job that you could do.
But so they're out there.
they're definitely out there. And I think it's happening more and more. That companies are recognizing that there are, in fact, specialists who can do it. Like a linguist, a sociolinguist, as you point out, is probably going to be better just on a ground level than, you know, your standard MBA, because they know about certain stuff. But doing interviews and eliciting data, the right kind of data that you want in an unbiased way, is exactly what all our training is about. So it just makes sense to do it. And I'm glad you brought up that point too about deadlines, because I am that way also. Like, I like having a deadline. If I don't have a deadline, I'll never get something done. And that was part of my problem in grad school, was that there weren't a lot of deadlines for things unless I was giving a paper at the LSA or something.
And even then, those deadlines are loose, because oftentimes there are extensions. There isn't a lot of money on the line. And like, the only person who would be negatively impacted typically is you, if you don't meet a deadline for your, you know, your dissertation or a paper. And so, I think there's Gretchen Rubin, I think is her name. She's kind of like one of these happiness experts. So she has this kind of this framework of four personality types based on how you are motivated. And I think these aren't, you know, groundbreaking. I think she just has a good way of talking about something we've already known, but it's kind of like whether you're internally motivated, externally motivated. And I think we're all trained to think that there's like this implicit bias, right? That everyone's supposed to be internally motivated all the time. And that would be cool, but it's not real. And if you know that you succeed and work better and are happier when you have external deadlines, then like, why wouldn't you set your life up to mirror that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And then the last point I want to make about this is that sometimes you're not going to know until you do it, right? Like, you may not have had the experience through your life up to and including graduate school of being in those situations where you know, work on things that have long deadlines or short deadlines or no deadlines to know about it. And that's perfectly okay. Like, you know, the job that you get out of grad school isn't probably going to be the job you work at for 10 years. And it may only be by trial and error that you find out where that sweet spot is for you. And that's fine. It doesn't mean you failed at something, it just means it wasn't the right fit for you. And you go on to the next thing until you find the thing that actually fits. And I think it's the healthiest thing in the world to just try to see what happens. And then who knows, you might get surprised and find out, oh, actually, I am good at this. Like, I can work in this environment. But
yeah,
you won't know till you try.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like a failure when I thought, oh, I've always wanted to have my own dance studio. Let's do it. Mm-hmm. And I, put a couple of months worth of thought into it and, some action. And then not having brought it to fruition did feel like a failure. I thought, mm-hmm. I'm supposed to be able to just get it together. Even if I'm not feeling it anymore, I should be able to, bring it to it's execution. That's not the right word. I guess that's what I did too. No, but to implement it. And I actually struggled with that for a while. And then I finally came to the realization that I was like, it's just one, I think we get so tied to our previous versions of ourselves that it's hard to adapt. And what I've actually said to my husband recently is, how fun would it be if time, which passes linearly from past to future, like in some languages, that, time metaphors are different. What if we actually experienced time from future to past? Then I would actually be more attached to my future identities. So maybe I should start being more attached to those ones so I can move forward with more ease. And I think that helped.
Yep, definitely. It's identity is always changing. And to get too wedded to a single identity is not going to serve you in the long run. You just need to be open to change, because everybody changes over time. And who you are now is just as valuable as who you were and who you will be eventually.
Yeah, I agree. I want to come back to walk folks through what it is that I do currently so they get an idea of what that is, because I wouldn't have known before. So I alluded to earlier where, a typical week will be something like, maybe I'm actively working on, four client projects. So that means we have four different companies who've hired us to do some kind of market research or branding work. And we do that work. And so I think now I've been here for a little over 3 months. I probably worked on over 20 client projects. So the workload is a lot. You get to learn a lot really fast. A typical week will be me interviewing. This is all virtual, unless the company flies us out for in-person interviews, if they prefer that. That hasn't happened for me yet, but it's happened before. So I'm either interviewing doctors or patients or caregivers about their experience with a particular disease state, a particular treatment, a particular pharmaceutical or device. And then let's say, each project might have, an average of 20 interviews, qualitative interviews. Then we take all that data and we, as a team, usually have maybe two or three of us to collectively make a report, right? So it's fun if you like making slides, on Canva or PowerPoint, and that's you like making conference presentations for your, academic papers. It's actually very fun and creative because you're making a visually pleasing version of what would otherwise be an academic report full of stats. Mm-hmm. So you're pulling quotes, you're catching patterns, you're quantifying categorical data. We also do quant surveys, which I haven't done as much work on because we have a team that's kind of got that covered and I'm more specialized for qual and personally enjoy it more. But I'll sometimes help build the surveys that we do for quants, making sure the language works, making sure the translations are right for Spanish. And then client meetings are another big one. I think that's something that some folks can get intimidated by. And I mean, I even get intimidated sometimes, but because the vibe is very different, I think, from academia. But it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of work, but you learn so much. And, my company serves the healthcare sector, but there's market research that serves all different kinds of sectors or is cross, industry. So there's so much opportunity for linguists to really thrive in market research companies or branding companies.
Yeah, I completely agree. I love it. And I wish there were more linguists. I was just thinking about what you said. I have found that my sociolinguistic training especially has been really helpful in things like client meetings, because it allows me to pick up on cues that other people might not about the best way to communicate with clients, cross-culturally, but also within, you know, standard white people, American culture. It's just stuff that you get sensitive to, and word choice and the way people prefer to communicate, because as the vendor, you sort of want to please your client, right? So you're looking for the best way to communicate with them. And I always try to listen really hard about not just what they're saying, but how they're saying it.
Exactly.
So that I can feed back to them in a way that they're going to hear and understand what I'm trying to say. It took me a long time to learn how to do that. Like, in the beginning, I was just sort of communicating in the way that I thought was best. And I had to learn, like, that's not always the best thing for the client because they may want a different way. So being a linguist helped me to hear what I needed to do and then to execute on the way I needed to change my own communication to work better with a client. And some people never really get the hang of that, but I think being a linguist really helps you figure out what to do and then do it.
Agreed. And there's times where I'll be on a call and, you know, here's a great example. I was recently doing a project for a client based on a particular treatment in the prostate cancer space. And so, you know, when I'm interviewing the doctors for this project, I have to do a ton of research so that I can intelligently and organically follow the conversation if we kind of deviate from the discussion guide. And so I kind of, you have to become like a mini expert on, you know, the disease state that you're working in. And so in all my research, the way that people were talking about a particular disease state within prostate cancer was metastatic hormone sensitive prostate cancer. But, you know, as you're talking with this, you know, particular urologist, this urologist might actually call that same disease state metastatic castrate sensitive instead of hormone sensitive. And so picking up on those little details so that throughout the rest of the conversation you use their preferred term. It's just small things like that that make the research better. And, you know, like there's other really cool linguistic projects I get to work on, like pharmaceutical brand naming. That's so fun. Like, like pharmaceutical brand names are awful, right? Like they're terrible.
Oh, tell me about it. I've been involved.
I mean, they're so bad, and but now it's fun because now I understand why. I mean, I see all the FDA regulations about text strings and how they can't be confusable, and you understand the constraints, and you can apply your creativity and your knowledge to like understand how to communicate a brand's commercial power, but also follow FDA guidelines. Like, it's a very fun, interesting project, and I just encourage, I really encourage people to think outside the box, because I think part of the big shift from academia to industry is that there's almost this feeling that you're giving up on like the, like you're turning into a corporate sellout, I think is kind of the terminology I feel like would resonate. And I felt a bit like that because I'm like, oh, like, I don't really want to be associated with pharma. Isn't that like a really big, evil, big pharma? Like, but I think it's so important to actually work in industry like that, because rather than avoiding these spaces that you think are manipulative or solely run on capitalistic agendas and are not serving people well, if the only people that, if everyone that's good, right, and good-hearted stays out of those spaces, it's worse for everyone.
Right. So totally.
We need people that are in it for the right reasons to understand what the actual constraints are. And then like, perhaps if they get lucky, you know, make some change. So it's been very enlightening.
I completely agree. It's a problem, right? We live in late capitalism, which is not great. I mean, there's a lot of bad things that are happening, but you can't leave it. Academia is not a refuge from capitalism. It's still capitalism. Like, you're still doing it. You might not know it, but you're still doing it. So you have to make a choice as to what you can work with and live with and where you can make a difference. I was just thinking, as you said that, someone that I had on the podcast recently, Brad Davison, works, he does something similar to what you do. He calls himself a medical anthropologist, and he is looking at this type of doctor-patient communication or doctor-doctor communication. And one of the things that he worked on was how to better communicate about the Gardasil vaccine. Because typically, companies have been not so great at doing it, and that, you know, it can really prevent death amongst so many people, men and women. So you are literally saving lives by working on something to communicate better to people about the benefits of a life-saving vaccine. And, you know, that's pretty good.
Absolutely. I think kind of growing up too, and like evolving with your career and moving in the industry also requires some of that. Like, yes, there are going to be some projects that you work, especially with project-based client work. There are going to be projects where you think this isn't moving the needle, right? Like this is, I'm doing research for one product that is competing with three other products, and they're all similar efficacy, similar tolerability. At the end of the day, if you know the patient were a family member, like to me, these are very similar, and helping branding for one company doesn't change much. But that's kind of part of the job. That's what pays the bills, keeps the lights on, and allows you to do the other projects that are like this Gardasil project, or like, you know, there was a cool project that we worked on that was, you know, a patient journey. So we interview patients, how they talk about their experience with severe acne vulgaris and how it affects their lives. And so it's like, you can't, I mean, and this is true of academia too. I think there's this belief that when you're in academia, every single project you work on should be your biggest passion. But those projects, you know, they go on for a while, you can lose steam, and sometimes they take you in a direction, especially with qualitative sociolinguistic work, they can take you in a direction that you're not as interested anymore. You don't think it's actually moving the needle. And I think it's just kind of like a professional reality that not every project is going to have this big societal impact. Sure. And I think that's okay. Yeah.
Sure. Of course it is. I mean, that's life. Not everything is super important. So this is great. We're coming to the end of our time here, but I want to ask you one more thing. Tell us about your TEDx talk.
So my TEDx talk is all about where comedy hides in language. And that actually came about because I was leading a data analysis workshop at University of Michigan. And while I was doing so, I had mentioned in one of my, you know, slides in passing as a joke, like, I did do stand-up for a long time. And so I said, hey, I have a stand-up show tonight if anyone wants to come. And one of the people that came ended up being an organizer for TEDx. And so they were like, the topics that you talked about in your stand-up and the fact that you can like weave them with linguistics is very interesting. Would you be interested in doing a TEDx? So that was really fun. And I really am so honored to have been able to be on the TEDx stage. It was really fun.
Yeah, that's great. Are you going to do comedy again one day, or are you done with that?
I think I say this on my LinkedIn, which is probably inappropriate, but I flirt with comedy. So it's like dance is my lifelong love affair. And then comedy is, I flirt with because, it comes with inspiration and kind of when I feel it. And so right now I'm, with being in the new position, I'm pretty occupied. So I haven't been on the stage in a little while, but I'm sure I'll be back in a couple months.
That's awesome. Another thing I think linguists are very good for, which is humor and comedy writing, because so much of it is about language. I love it when comedians get deep into language. It's so interesting and so fun.
I will say the last thing, and I'll actually let us end, but I did just recently connect with a researcher at The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
Cool.
Who's getting me tickets to see Jon Stewart, and I'm so excited.
Oh, that's great.
This is also just because I reached out to him on LinkedIn. So continue to nurture LinkedIn. But I think writing on the John Oliver Last Week Tonight Show would be like a dream job, right? It's like language, comedy. social
all
impact.
That.
So
And I'll say one of my favorite comedians is Eddie Izzard, because the work that she does with language is incredible. And I've seen her live a couple times, and it's so quick and it's so funny.
So
and it's just amazing stuff. So I consider her the comedian for linguists. Basically.
Oh, that's such a good quote. Can we make that a quote soundbite for this episode?
Oh, all right. Well, thank you so much, Emily. This has been such a delight to chat with you. Is it okay if I put your LinkedIn link in the show notes in case people want to contact you for advice or interview?
That would be awesome. I love connecting with folks. So please, share
awesome.
And please feel free to reach out to me.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Laurel.
Linguistics Career Launch 2021 was a one-month intensive program intended to familiarize linguistics students and faculty with career options beyond academia in business, tech, government, and nonprofit organizations. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. LCL 2021 was organized by Nancy Frischberg, Alexander Johnston, Emily Pace, Susan Steele, and Laurel Sutton. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.